Newton's bucket versus Einstein's elevator. In fact, how actually this ingenious idea of Einstein could defeat 300 years old accepted idea of explanation of Newton's bucket. And I also told you, so the idea is that you can simulate gravity by acceleration. And so if you are inside the elevator, you cannot, there's no way you could distinguish the true gravity from the accelerating system. Or if you are not accelerating and you see, for example, particles or light moving, they move in the straight line if there is no influence of other forces. And of course, this must be equivalent to, so if I have an elevator which is in true gravitational field, which is, however, now freely falling down. So if the elevator is freely falling down, so I showed you yesterday that in the true gravitational field, the trajectories get bent by the presence of the gravitational field. But now if I look at that trajectory from a freely falling system, they would look exactly straight, right? So I can get rid of gravity by going to the freely falling system, to the inertial frame, okay? So that's great. So I told you that it bends the trajectories. So let's have a look at this more closely, how the trajectories are really bent, right? So third consequence of equivalence principle, the first one was this gravitational redshift. Second one is this bending of light or bending of trajectories in more general. So let's look at this more closely. So geodesic equation. And since now on, I'll always set C equal to 1. Not to bother with that. And then maybe later on, we'll also set G equal to 1 and H bar equal to 1 and pi equal to 1 and so on. Okay. So let me assume, so let's put mathematical structure to this idea that if we freely fall, we saw straight lines, and if we don't freely fall, we saw curved lines. Okay, so let's psi mu be local coordinates, which are freely falling. Freely falling system. So in local inertial frame, if you want. Okay. And let x alpha, so that would be the psi mu would be coordinates which are associated with this freely falling elevator. And x alpha be the coordinates, the global coordinates I look at from outside. So x alpha, of course, there is some relation between x and psi. So there'll be any global coordinates. Global coordinates. For example, those associated with the observer who is static at the surface of the Earth. Okay, so now what will be the. So in our inertial frame, the physics must be like in special relativity, right? So in our inertial frame, the equation of motion is d square psi mu over d tau square equals to 0. That's the straight line, right? So straight line in local inertial frame. So now let me calculate what it means, how it will look like in the x coordinates. So we have the equation that 0 equals to d square psi mu over d tau square equals to, so what is it equal to? It's d over d tau. And now d psi mu over d tau, I'll write in terms of x mu. So it's d psi mu over dx alpha over d tau. So now I apply this derivative into two terms, so I'll get two terms, right? So I'll have this equals to d, so let's first differentiate the second term, for example, d psi mu over dx alpha and I have d square x alpha over d tau square. So that's the differentiating the second term, this one here, and now I differentiate the first term, so I'll have d square psi mu over dx beta dx alpha dx beta over d tau, and what I had before was dx alpha over d tau, right? And this is equal to zero. I'm just using, what is it, chain rule. Okay, so now observation, very simple. So what is, if I have two coordinates, let's say dx nu over dx alpha, what is this equal to? Huh? Delta nu alpha. So only if these two coordinates are the same, we get one, otherwise we get zero. So this is delta nu alpha, but I can also write this in terms of the psi coordinate. So dx nu over d psi mu d psi mu over dx alpha. Okay, so that's our relation. So the product of these two things will be just delta function here. Okay. So now I use that to get rid of this prefactor here. So if you look at this prefactor here, I don't want that. So how I can get rid of that is that I'll multiply it, the whole equation, by this thing here, and that will produce me delta on the right hand side. So I will have, so I can just separate this d square from there. Okay. So multiply the equation by dx nu over d psi mu, which is precisely this term. So then that term times that term gives me just delta. So I'll have delta square x nu over d tau square plus, so now I have to have that term there. So that dx nu over d psi mu. And then what I had before, so it's d square psi mu over dx beta dx alpha, and then dx beta d tau dx alpha d tau, and this is equal to zero. Okay, so now how to proceed further, right? It's very simple. So what is this guy here? It's the velocity, it's the four velocity in these coordinates. So this is u beta. Similarly, this is u alpha. What is this? It's the derivative of that. So it's du nu over d tau. So we recognize these terms. That's perfect. Okay. And now this looks really ugly. And whenever something looks really ugly, you just call it a name, right? So you don't try to do anything with it. So if you look at the structure, there is a free index nu. Over this index, we contract, so mu is not there, and beta and alpha. So let's call this object gamma, nu, beta, and alpha. Okay. So we have an equation that in arbitrary curved coordinates, x, the equation of motion, well, which determines the trajectory, is du nu over d tau plus gamma nu alpha beta. Okay, and this term is exactly the same as that term. So if I switch alpha and beta, nothing happens, right? So this guy is actually symmetric in alpha and beta. It's entirely up to me where I write alpha and where I write beta. So g nu alpha beta u alpha u beta equals to zero. This is called geodesic equation. And it tells you how the trajectory looks like in arbitrary coordinates.
Okay, so that's perfect.
So we have beautiful equation. Well, let us probe a little bit more what these gammas are. Okay, and in order to do that, we also have to transform our metric into these curve coordinates. So how do we do that?
So we have ds square, which is minus d tau square. So basically, the proper time is, you define proper time square to be minus of the proper distance square.
And that's because ds square for time-like particles is negative, right? So you want to parameterize your particle by something positive. So the tau flows this direction. So that's why I choose this minus here. So anyway, so now in our coordinates, which are freely falling, we have just special relativities. It's eta mu nu d psi mu d psi nu, right? But now I want to express this in terms of x. So this will be
eta mu nu d psi mu over d x alpha d psi nu over d x beta d x alpha d x beta.
So again, the same trick. I have some beast here. Index mu is contracted. Nu is contracted. So there are two indices, alpha and beta. So let's give it a name, g alpha beta. Again, it's symmetric because alpha and beta are exchangeable. And so we have a relation that this equals to g alpha beta dx alpha dx beta. And this g alpha beta is curved metric. So whereas we started with eta mu nu, which was minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1 on the diagonal, now, because of these transformation matrices, we can basically get an arbitrary curve metric. So, and it's 4 by 4 symmetric matrix. So in general, it has 10 components. So 10 components. Okay, so now I can divide by d tau again. So I'll find out just, so we had before minus c squared equals to eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. So now this generalizes to dx alpha, g alpha, u beta. So, okay, just a trivial consequence of this equation. Okay, so we have curve metric. So now, let's have a look what these gammas are. Yeah?
This particular formulation for just a transformed metric would in general have non-zero curvature,
right? Yeah, the curvature is zero. Yeah. That's a good point. I'll return to this in a minute. Okay? So, if you look at this expression for gamma, you know, it is a term which has one partial derivative like that and then second derivative of psi mu. If you look at the expression of this guy here, then it has actually one partial derivative, another partial derivative. So it doesn't take much time, actually, to think that if I take a derivative of my metric g, right, I will create one second derivative and one first derivative, right? So obviously, gamma and dg have the same structure, well, similar structure, right? So if I take the derivative of g, then I create exactly terms like that. Okay, so now statement, which if you want, you can prove in three lines, but I will not do that. So statement. So gamma nu alpha beta. Okay, let me define one more object just to be fancy. So this I'll define to be rise index of an object which has index down.
gamma mu alpha beta.
Okay, so these objects, both of them have special name. I'll call it Christoffel symbols.
Symbols, and they are very important objects.
So actually, people introduce different names for when the index is up and then the index is down. So this is Christoffel symbol of the first kind, and this is the Christoffel symbol of the second kind. Okay, and the statement is, there is a simple formula for this one here in terms of the derivatives of the metric. And that formula is gamma mu alpha beta. So notice that we have actually lowered or raised the first index here. So second and the third index, there is a symmetry between second and the third index. So this guy is symmetric here, that guy is symmetric there. Right? So now the expression which I will have must be symmetric in these two indices. So how to do that? So it's 1/2, why not? Okay. G mu alpha partial derivative with respect to beta. So okay, I put that term there. It's obviously not symmetric in alpha and beta, so I have to add another term which looks like that, but this opposite thing. So it's plus G mu beta alpha, right? So now it's symmetric in alpha and beta. But it's still not the whole story. I can still have something which is symmetric in an alpha and beta, and that's the metric. So it's minus chi alpha beta and mu. And that's the expression for the Christoffel symbol of the first kind.
Yeah? Why is this called the affine connection, and then after you impose something on the metric?
Okay, you will see that either today or tomorrow, more specifically here. You know, I'm doing this with that definition of the metric and with that definition of the Christoffel symbols. And they are automatically actually metric connection. So that's why these guys are called Christoffel symbols. Whenever you can write gamma in terms of the metric only, it's called Christoffel symbol. Yeah, but I'll return to this probably today or tomorrow. Okay, so that's the expression. So how would you prove that? I said that I will not prove it, but I'll just.
Okay, so proof by brute force, right?
So
you have to calculate what chi mu alpha beta term, for example, is. Mu alpha beta term is, okay, so this is d over dx beta.
And now my definition of the metric, so it's eta, let's put some indices kappa and sigma, d psi kappa over d x mu, d psi sigma over d x alpha. Okay, so that's my metric, that's the definition of the metric. So now I can pull this eta out because that's a constant, right? I can pull it out.
So this is eta kappa sigma, and again I have to differentiate two terms,
pain,
d square psi kappa over d x beta d x kappa, d x mu, d psi sigma d x alpha, and then the other term, so psi kappa.
Can you read my Greek letters? Or it's very difficult? I think it's difficult, right? Okay. You're trying to teach me at least write beta properly, but I never learned.
So d square psi sigma over dx beta dx alpha.
Oh, well, all I'm doing is I'm just using, you know, multiplying out by using the Leibniz rule. Okay, and then, so let's look at this term, for example. And okay, so I'm not claiming this term. Okay, I claim that this term is d psi kappa over dx, another index iota, for example, comma iota beta mu. Okay, let me prove that. Okay, so okay, so this is d psi kappa over dx iota, and then I'm using the definition, that definition for gamma. So this will be d square psi iota over d dx iota d psi delta and d square psi delta over d x beta d x mu. Okay, so this is the definition of the gamma symbol. So it's iota delta delta beta mu. Okay, and then if you look at this guy here, it's nothing than the delta, and so that proves that that proves that this guy, the whole thing here, equals to that term here. Okay. Terrible. Brute force is always terrible. Okay, so I claim that this first term is that. So now, similar thing will be here. So again, it will be some first derivative and the gamma here. But now, if you look at that term, and that term, how do they combine? How do they combine, right? They combine to my definition of G. So this will be G iota alpha, right? So this equals to G iota alpha, and then the gamma there, gamma iota beta mu. And the statement is that the second term will be roughly a similar thing. So it's G mu iota gamma iota alpha beta. Okay. Pain, pain, pain. So I calculated one partial derivative of the metric. And I have these two things here. So now what you have to do is to calculate the second one here. So somehow you rotate indices in what you got. And the third one here. Right? And then you combine them in exactly this way. And you proved that left-hand side equals to right-hand side, right? So okay, so plus two other terms. And that's your homework if you want. But it's very simple. Now, once we have this expression, you know, you just rotate the indices, right? Okay, plus two other terms, and that gives you the proof. Yeah?
How much freedom and choice do we have for these locally inertial coordinate systems? Because, like, if you look toward special relativity, like, when you do the coordinate transformation, there's a whole bunch of Lorentz transformations.
That's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah. So you have that freedom there.
So
what? No, that's absolutely right. So yeah, you have in your local inertial frame, you have additional freedom of choosing your coordinates by doing the Lorentz transformation. Doesn't change anything what I have done here, right?
So I guess local inertial coordinates are defined by that.
Up to these.
Or that, like, by that equation on the top where the d squared psi is zero.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay,
well, in all those frames, it will look like that, right? Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So as long as we have, like, d psi squared theta squared equals zero, we know we're in inertial coordinates. We know we're in inertial frame.
So that equation we started with will be valid in any inertial frame. So no, so if you start with one, then go to the other one with Lorentz transformation, it will be preserved. Yeah. Yeah. And then so you start in any inertial frame, and then you go to curved frame, and you get this equation. Mm-hmm. Very good. So we have actually solved we have found the geodesic equation. It's amazing, right? Just using the equivalence principle. So
the last thing, which actually somebody already mentioned probably yesterday and today as well, so warning.
So this is all very nice, but of course the true gravitational field is not homogeneous, right? So if I have actually a big elevator here and tiny Earth here, then you know that the force here, you are much closer than here. So the gravitational force will be much smaller here than it is here. But also, actually, I want to go like that. So it will not go parallel to each other, but rather it will be, so I'll be this thing here, and there'll be that thing here, that thing there. So it's not homogeneous gravitational field. So if I had huge elevator and non-homogeneous gravitational field, then I would actually see things. So one particle would fall just straight down, the other one would be getting closer to the first one, and so on. Right? So general inhomogeneous and blah 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 other non-stationary and other things, gravitational field. So now, even if I go to the freely falling system, then let's say one of the particles will not move with respect to me, but the others will still, because they have different, you know, they are getting closer, they are getting further away, and blah blah. This one is accelerated more, this one is accelerated less. So only for one particle, actually, I can get rid of that acceleration. Okay. So in general, in homogeneous gravitational field, general gravitational field cannot be entirely mimicked by acceleration. Okay, so cannot get rid of gravity except at a point. Okay. But what will still remain true? Do you have a question? No. Okay, so that's just a warning. So what we have done is basically correct, but not entirely correct. So basically our elevator cannot be arbitrarily big. It must be a small elevator. So, and in a small elevator, what we have done will be true. Okay, but if you have big elevator, so everything is true only locally. But what is more generally true is that the gravitational field, so we have seen that we see, for example, the effects of the gravity by these coefficients gamma. Yeah?
When you say you cannot get rid of gravity, do you mean
Well, we could have get rid of gravity by going to the freely falling system, right?
So
we wouldn't experience any gravity if you were there.
Right.
So you cannot, I'm saying we could do that in homogeneous gravitational field completely. Right. Here I'm saying you cannot do it completely, only at a point. In a very small neighborhood And that depends on how much your field is inhomogeneous. If it's nearly homogeneous, you can make your elevator bigger. If it's really bad, your elevator must be very, very small. So, but what is true anyway, in full gravity, that gravitational field is described by now metric G mu nu, which is now not necessarily related to where is it? So it's middle. Not really. So in our definition of the metric, we started with the flat metric, and we did some coordinate transformation to it, right? So that was our metric. It was a very special metric. It's actually, you know, just related to this one by coordinate transformation. So now I'm saying in general gravitational field, it will be still metric which describes our gravity. But there is not necessarily a transformation which would transform that to the flat metric. So this is general metric now. But otherwise, everything stays the same. So ds square is g mu nu dx nu dx nu. Because we do describe gravity by metric, and metric tells us how to measure distances, how to measure angles, and stuff like that. In other words, how to do the geometry. So it tells you that gravity equals to the geometry. Okay, so for this, you will need to study so-called Riemannian geometry or pseudo-Riemannian geometry. You'll need to study where this metric can live. You will need to study manifolds and tensors and blah, 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 which will start at the end of today's lecture. But one more thing I want to mention here is that it is also a gauge theory. It is also a gauge theory because metric is not really physical. It's not physical. What I mean by that is that you wouldn't see true physical effects by looking at the metric only. You need to actually, so it may happen that you will see the same effects for different metrics. Right? So the metric is not the physics. The physics and the information about the gravitational field is encoded in an object which is called Riemann tensor. Tensor, which is basically second derivative of the metric, so governs physical effects. So it's similar to the electromagnetism. We know that we can help ourselves if we don't consider F mu nu, but consider A mu, the electric potentials. But there is some gauge freedom still in the potentials. So here's the same thing. So G mu nu is basically like a potential for our theory, but we need to construct the field strength for it, right? Which will be the thing which describes gravity. Okay, so we'll start that in half an hour. But before we do that, let's do some more physics. Okay, questions to this?
So the equivalence principle works only locally.
So everything is valid, but only locally.
Okay. So if I have a situation where I have an accelerated frame, you're saying that I can always find a coordinate transformation so that my new frame looks like you have no acceleration.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's a unique way of doing that? I can find different coordinate transformations that take me from one frame to the other.
Well, in the end, there's definitely this Lorentz transformation freedom. But other than that, I would say there's never a unique way, but almost a unique way, yeah. Okay. I don't know. So we started with the conceptual path to the theory. It was part A. Part B is the equivalence principle. So now let's look at the Newtonian limit. So now we are claiming we are going from Newton's gravity, which was described by, everybody knows that Newton's gravity can be described by Newton's potential, gravitational potential phi, right? So we went from phi to an object which is g mu nu. So we went from one scalar to 10 objects here. G mu nu has 10 components, right? So now how that can be that these are actually the same thing? So when do we expect the Newtonian limit? So let's look at this equation, geodesic equation, and we want to, so this must be something like the Newton's law, right? That acceleration is minus gradient of the phi, where phi is the gravitational potential. This must be that in the Newtonian limit. So what is the Newtonian assumptions? So first, we have to have slow motion, right? Because we know that Newtonian physics is only for non-relativistic motion. So what does it mean? Is that if I have my coordinates, then my velocities are much smaller than actually how the time passes, right? So this tells you nothing else than the velocity, the magnitude of velocity is much smaller than the velocity of light. Okay, so I move in space much less than I move in time, right? Okay. So if this is true, then my geodesic equation d square x mu over d tau square, I can neglect all the terms which look like this. Right? So I'll have only the zero component of my four velocity, u alpha and u beta. Okay, so this will be gamma mu zero component and then dt over d tau square equals to the zero. Right? So otherwise, I would have many more terms, but they are simply much smaller, so I neglect them. Okay, so it's slow motion. Another thing is stationary field. So you know that if the gravitational field is actually time varying, I cannot use Newton's gravity because there everything was, you know, static limit of the field theory, right? So stationary field, what it means is that if I have any time derivative of my metric, this must be equal to zero, right? So that metric is not time varying. So let's calculate this object here then. So gamma mu zero zero. Now I will use this definition here. So alpha is zero and beta is zero. So it is 1/2. So now if beta is zero, then this term is not there because I'm in stationary field. If alpha is zero, that term is not there. And all I'm left with is actually this term here, right? So this equals to minus 1/2 g zero zero and mu, okay? And then, okay, so that will be for the index down. And now I have to raise it up with this metric as well. Okay, so let's put mu. G nu mu. Okay, so that's another Newtonian assumption. So third assumption is that my gravitational field must be very weak, right? Otherwise, I cannot say anything. If my gravitational field is strong, Newton never encountered that, so he never had to solve that, right? But okay, so weak field. And what does it mean is that my metric equals to almost my Minkowski metric. So I can choose coordinates where my metric is almost a Minkowski metric. But I allow for small perturbation. So this h mu nu will be, you know, small deviation from my flat Minkowski metric. And I neglect all the terms which are of high order in h. Okay. So far, so good?
Where are you referring yourself to a field?
Sorry?
What do you call the field in this context?
Well, I call field my g mu nu.
Okay.
Yeah.
So at a point, you can always write g mu nu as a to b nu, right? But you're saying that you can extend this over the whole space-time for the case of... Okay.
Yeah.
You're saying globally...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very good. So now, in order to calculate my this guy here, I need an inverse metric. So what is g mu nu equal to? So I know how to write synthesis in eta mu nu. So it'll be eta mu nu. And claim is that this is minus h mu nu, where the indices are raised by the flat metric. Eta mu nu. Okay. So let me check that very schematically. So I want that this guy is inverse to that guy. So I want that this, well, when I multiply them, I get delta and plus some small correction. Okay, so let's do it. So g mu nu schematically is eta minus h. And then I multiply the matrix with eta plus h. These are indices up, these are indices down. So what I get, so I have eta, which is delta, right? And I have h and eta, which is minus h. Then I have eta and h, which is plus h. And then I have h square, so plus oh h square, right? So now h minus h is 0, of course, so I proved it. Okay, so this is, if you don't like this, write it in indices, and you know, it's an interesting exercise. Okay, so what does it mean? Is that g mu 0, 0 and now I'll keep only terms which are linear in H. Okay, so if you look at the structure, it has two terms. It has the term with derivative and the term without derivative. So now if I differentiate, so now I put g equal to eta plus h. But eta is a constant, right? Eta is a constant. So if I differentiate a constant, I get 0. So this term actually, what contributes here must be h. Right? So it's minus 1 half h 0, 0 over nu. Okay. And now this term is already small because it contains h. So I can, so instead of g nu mu, I just write eta nu mu. Good. So we are ready to get the fruits of our work. So these are all the assumptions we are doing. So now let me write this equation again. So let's, this is the star equation. So now write star for various components. For components, various components. So first, mu equal to 0. Okay. So we have d square x 0 equals to d tau square. And what about the other term? So I told you that we are in the stationary fields, right? Which means that whenever I have time derivative of my metric, it will be 0, right? So this means that basically if nu is 0, then this guy is not there. So OK, so I need gamma 0, so plus gamma 0, 0, and then dt over d tau square. OK, so if I want gamma 0, 0, I need to have 0 here. Mu must be equal to 0, then the nu must be equal to 0, right? Because of the form. So the nu must be equal to 0. But that's 0 by definition of the stationary field. Okay, so this guy is 0, however. So what it means is that, okay, let me write, okay, doesn't matter. So x0 is t, right? So what it means is dt over d tau equals to c, which is some constant. Everybody happy? Okay. So now let's look at index I here. So usually you split indices mu into 0 and I. So 0 is time and I are spatial indices. So writing it for I, so mu equals to I have d square xi over d tau square plus gamma I 0, 0. And now I have dt over d tau square, but that's my constant, right? So I just proved that it is constant. So this is constant square. Constant square equals to 0. So that's my equation for the other component. Okay. So now this is with respect to tau, but I can also differentiate with respect to t. And I will pick up the term dt over d tau, but that's a constant, right? So this guy here is d square xi over dt square, dt over d tau square, which is c square. Okay, so that's this term. And that term. Yeah, very good, yeah. So it's minus 1/2, and if you want, yeah. How do I write it? D of I H 0, 0, if you want. Everybody agrees with this. Okay, so I have constant here, I cancel those. So I have an equation that D square XI over DT square equals to 1/2 DI H 0, 0. Okay, so that's our equation. So now we want to compare this with Newton. And you know that the Newtonian's law is d square xi over dt square equals to minus di of phi, where phi is a Newtonian gravitational potential. Everybody knows this. But it's funny because people know this from electromagnetism, right? That there is some electrostatic potential and blah, blah, blah. But there is direct analogy between electrostatics and the gravity. And so this is like an electrostatic potential, but now it's for gravitational field. So Newtonian gravitational potential. Okay. So what does it mean? So I want to compare this equation with that equation here. So what do I conclude? Perfect. So phi must be minus 1/2 H 0, 0. Or in other words, if I write the full G00, which was eta plus h, right? So G00 and eta 00 is minus 1. And this is minus 1 plus. And let me cheat here. I said c equal to 1. Let me restore it back so that you have the full formula. It's 2 phi over c square. And that's it. So the statement is that if you are doing actually a Newtonian limit, of general relativity, then you have general metric g mu nu. But what is important and how you translate it to Newtonian theory is that G00 is minus 1 plus the Newtonian gravitational potential over c square. Yes. Oh no, okay. Very, very stupid. This c square is the velocity of light. Sorry. And that c is big C. It's some constant c. Okay, sorry for that. So now note. So when actually, Einstein gravity will be important, So phi over c square is gm of the body over c square times r. And so your Newtonian approximation will be well valid when this is much more than 1, because then it is a small correction. Right? So for validity of my Newtonian approximation, I need that phi over c square is a small correction to this one here, so it must be much smaller than 1. Okay, so now you can look at the value of look at the values of phi over c square. And so you can look at how this looks like on the surface of various objects. So for example, surface of a proton. Right? So if you have surface of the proton, it has some mass. The radius of the proton is something. You calculate phi over c square, and you find that this is 10 to minus 39. So that's fine. So Newtonian approximation will be only there. So what about Earth? Surface of the Earth, you plug mass of the Earth, radius of the Earth, and you find that this is 10 to minus 9. So your gravitational field is that weak, actually, in the vicinity of the surface of the Earth. That's why Newtonian physics works perfectly well here. Right? Okay, so you can go further. You can do sum. It's 10 to minus 6. Newtonian physics will be absolutely valid there. 10 to minus 6 is still very, very tiny. But there are objects in the space which they are not so. So neutron star. You find that this is 10 to minus 2 to 10 to minus 1. So if you are using Newtonian physics, well, you may be wrong 10% or whatever here already. Okay, and then there are black holes, which are also confirmed now. And then it's 10 to minus 1 to 1, depending on which black hole you have and blah, blah. So you may be 100% wrong if you are using Newtonian physics for calculating black holes. And this comes from the fact that if you associate the radius of the black hole with so-called gravitational radius, which Neil will derive next week, and this is 2gm over c square. So if you have a black hole of the mass m, then you find it associates with it the gravitational radius, which is this guy here. And if you plug it there, you find that the black holes have correction 10 to minus 1 up to 1. Okay. So yesterday we had 5 minutes break. Do you want 5 minute break? Okay, let's have 5 minute break and let's start at 10.